Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 959. Update on the new Cold War and the Nazification of Ukraine. This is being recorded on June 1st of the year 2017. The title of the program pretty much indicates what we're going to be talking about. By and large, we will be talking about Ukraine and the Nazification of Ukraine and things relevant to that. We're going to be talking about Ukraine's strategic slash commercial role as a major producer of grains. And this figures largely into the dynamic of how to feed people, particularly as I'm speaking on June 1st, with Trump having done what he said he would do, and that is pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Change Accords, the effects of climate change on food production figure to be drastic indeed. I also think that what we are going to be talking about with Ukraine impinges directly on some of the things that I spoke about in For the Record 912 and also in AFA 39. Yes, I have added to the Anti-Fascist Archives series. I haven't done one since the early 90s. That will be available, and the description for that will be available on the Spitfire website. And we're going to be talking not only about Ukraine, but also about the new Cold War. With, quote, Russian intelligence or, quote, Russians, unquote, having supposedly hacked Emmanuel Macron's campaign in France, and these, quote, Russian intelligence, unquote, hackers supposedly being the same ones who hacked the DNC, this being a major element of not only the new Cold War, but the, frankly, preposterous charges that Russia interfered in our campaign. I think if I had not seen how the utter BS of this Russia hacked the DNC, etc., a really, really, really bad, clumsy, almost laughable cyber false flag operation, I'm not sure I would have believed that people could give credence to such a thing. On the other hand, there is an awful lot of serious BS going on. We're going to revisit the hacking of Emmanuel Macron, supposedly done by the same elements that hacked the DNC and hacked the German parliament, the Bundestag. And not only is this an obvious cyber false flag operation, but it points in the direction of the American far right and what is being euphemized as, quote, alt-right, unquote. And in fact, one of the people who looms large is a brilliant Nazi hacker named Andrew Auerheimer, A-U-E-R-E-N-H-E-I-M-E-R, who was also the web architect or site architect for the Daily Stormer, arguably the most important of the white supremacist slash Nazi slash alt-right blogs slash websites. Auerheimer, not incidentally, was a guest at the party held by Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras after they received the prestigious Polk Award. We're going to begin by taking a look at something which is receiving very little coverage, none to speak of in the American mainstream media, bloody little of it in the mainstream media elsewhere. And what we're going to look at here is not only significant because of what the individual said, this individual being a guy named Vasily, V-A-S-I-L-Y, Volk, V-O-V-K, I may be mispronouncing that. He was not only a senior officer with the SBU, the Ukrainian Intelligence Service, but he was in charge of the Ukrainian Intelligence Service's investigation, and that belongs in quotes, quote, investigation, unquote, into the shootdown of Malaysian Airlines flight MH370. 17. So that is the person we're talking about here. From the Jewish Chronicle of May 11th of 2017, an article by Sam Sokol, S-O-K-O-L, Ukrainian general calls for destruction of Jews, unquote. I'm telling you one more time, go to hell, Kikes, wrote senior officer affiliated to the intelligence services. In the latest of a series of highly public anti-Semitic statements by prominent figures in Ukraine, a retired Ukrainian general affiliated with the country's intelligence services this week called for the destruction of his country's Jewish community. In a post since deleted from Facebook, Vasily Volk, a general who holds a senior reserve rank with the Security Service of Ukraine, the local successor to the KGB, wrote that Jews, quote, aren't Ukrainians, and I will destroy you along with Ukrainian oligarch and Jewish lawmaker Vadim Vadim Rabinovich, R-A-B-I-N-O-V-Y-C-H. I'm telling you one more time, go to hell, Kikes. The Ukrainian people have had it to hear with you, unquote. Ukraine must be governed by Ukrainians, he wrote. And we're going to come back to this article in just a second. But to give you an idea of how significantly this fellow, Vasily Volk, fits into the ongoing, frankly, propaganda behind the new Cold War, from the news.au.com site by Charles Miranda, M-I-R-A-N-D-A, of June 7th of 2016, MH-17 investigators reveal an exhaust of a Russian-built Buk missile was found at the crash site. Skipping down. Ahead of its release, Ukraine's former top SBU security services official Vasil Vovk, who until June of last year was the country's chief investigator on the multinational probe, said he knew who was responsible, but conceded it was not conclusive. I am confident that this missile system was delivered from the territory of the Russian Federation with a high-skilled crew, most likely a crew of well-trained officers, of course, from Russian territory, he said. And again, the credibility of that, aside from the many things we have spoken about in connection with this, and the evidence suggests that it was actually Ukrainian security forces who fired the missile, not Russians or pro-Russian or ethnic Russian rebels in eastern Ukraine. The general political outlook and credibility of this guy, Vasil or Vasily Volk, I think can be weighed with this basically a call for a new Holocaust of Ukraine's Jews. Returning to the Jewish Chronicle article, other prominent Ukrainians have weighed in with somewhat less ripe statements. Meanwhile, Ukrainian war hero turned lawmaker Nadia Savchenko, S-A-V-C-H-E-N-K-O, came under fire in March after saying during a television interview that Jews held disproportionate control over the levers of power in Ukraine. More recently, opposition politician Yulia Tymoshenko was forced to apologize after being filmed laughing at an anti-Semitic comedy act at a gathering of her Fatherland Party, and Volodymyr Vyatrovich, director of the state-run Institution for National Memory, accused Jewish activist Edward Dolinsky of fabricating anti-Semitic incidents for money. Vyatrovich is also running a public awareness campaign whitewashing the participation of the Ukrainian Insurgent Army, or UPA, a Ukrainian nationalist militia, in the Holocaust. In 2015, the Ukrainian parliament passed a law prohibiting the denigration of the UPA and other groups which fought for the country's independence. Earlier this month, Ukraine made waves internationally when it announced it was opening a murder investigation into the killing of a member of UPA by a 94-year-old Jewish ex-KGB agent in the early 1950s. Ukraine has not prosecuted any of its citizens for war crimes against Jews since the country gained its independence following the breakup of the Soviet Union, something that should come as no great surprise. We're going to go into the OUNB Nazification of the Ukrainian service. Suffice it to say, in numerous past programs, we have talked about Volodymyr Vyatrovich and his institute or institution for national memory. This is a almost doctrinaire Orwellian institution that has stood Ukraine's history on its head and is portraying the Nazi-allied OUNB and UPA as heroes, protectors of Jews, and so forth, even portraying the 14th Waffen-SS Division, the Galician Division, as having protected Jews against the Holocaust. It is an absolute Orwellian reversal of facts. The war on journalistic and historical truth in Ukraine is also taking place in a much more physical and corporeally lethal way. The investigative reporter Pavel, P-A-V-E-L, Sheremet, and I may be mispronouncing this, S-H-E-R-E-M-E-T, was killed by a bomb. And although our media have portrayed this as probably the work of Russians or somebody affiliated with Russia, in fact, the evidence points in the direction of the Ukrainian intelligence service and the OUNB fascists who were put back in charge in Ukraine and are running the Ukrainian national security apparatus, including its military. From The Guardian of May 10th of 2017, article by Alec Luhn, L-U-H-N, Ukraine spy agency may have seen planting of bomb that killed journalist. What this article points out is that not only did the SBU film the bombing, but the available evidence points strongly in the direction of their complicity in the planting of the bomb. Certainly they filmed it and therefore should be able to apprehend the perpetrators if they really were interested in so doing. It turns out that the SBU had Mr. Sheremet under surveillance, and that is how apparently they were able to film the planting of the bomb. Again, Ukraine's spy agency may have seen planting a bomb that killed journalists, by Alec Luhn, Guardian, May 10th of this year, 2017. New film suggests an intelligence services agent was present when device was hidden under Pavel Sheremet's car last July. A new documentary film alleged that Ukraine's spy agency may have witnessed the planting of a car bomb that killed a prominent journalist last July in Kiev. Pavel Sheremet had just left his home in the Ukrainian capital and was driving to work when his car exploded. The murder was the most high-profile assassination of a reporter in the country since the beheading in 2000 of the investigative reporter Georgi Gongadze, G-O-N-G-A-D-Z-E. Ukraine's president, Petro Poroshenko, has said it was a matter of honor, unquote, that Sheremet's case be promptly solved. He called for a transparent investigation by police and the security services. However, 10 months later, no one has been arrested. Given that, for example, the former number two man in the Azov battalion is now heading up the Kiev police force, the Azov battalion being one of the explicitly Nazi elements in the Ukrainian army, being armed, by the way, with U.S. taxpayer money and sporting the SS rune and the swastika on their combat helmets, this should not come as much of a surprise. Returning to the Guardian article and the documentary film, the film, Killing Pavel, suggests but an agent working for Ukraine's intelligence services was present when the explosive device was hidden under the journalist's car. The Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, or OCCRP, and Sladislav Info released the documentary on Wednesday when it was screened on Ukrainian TV. Investigators have said Sheremet was killed by a remotely detonated explosive device, most likely in retribution for his investigative work in Ukraine and other places. The journalist supported the pro-Western uprising in 2014 that saw Viktor Yanukovych flee to Russia, but had also been bitingly critical of Ukraine's new authorities. Surveillance camera footage published by the media and police revealed that an unknown man and a woman approached Sheremet's Subaru car on the street the night before the blast. The woman is seen kneeling beside the parked car on the driver's side. The makers of Killing Pavel tracked down new surveillance footage not found by police. It gives fresh details of the apparent killers who returned to the scene the next morning shortly before Sheremet got into his doomed vehicle. The footage reveals several suspicious men who arrived in the street that night. They appeared to be carrying out surveillance. They were still there when the man and the woman went past and allegedly fixed the bomb that killed Sheremet. The Bellingcat Citizen Journalist Group managed to identify their car, a gray Skoda, and its registration. The investigative reporters subsequently tracked down one of the men and identified him as Igor, I-G-O-R, Ustimenko, U-S-T-I-M-E-N-K-O. Ustimenko admitted being in the area that night and said he had been hired as a private investigator to keep watch on someone's children. He denied seeing the bombers and said police had not contacted him. The reporters then spoke to a government source. He confirmed that Ustimenko had been working since 2014 for Ukraine's SBU Secret Intelligence Service. Ustimenko declined to comment further. The film also presented evidence suggesting that Sheremet was under surveillance in the weeks before his murder. Ukraine's Interior Minister Arsen Avakov has denied the government carried this out. That guy, by the way, very closely affiliated with the Azov Battalion. Something about the recent history of the Ukrainian intelligence service. It has been headed up until a couple of years ago by a guy named Valentin, V-A-L-E-N-T-Y, and some of these spellings, by the way, vary since the original spelling. Originally, they are in the Cyrillic alphabet, and they are transliterated variously. The guy's last name mostly is transliterated as N-A-L-Y-V-A-I-C-H-E-N-K-O. He is not only a doctrinaire O-U-N-B fascist, but like Volodymyr Vyatrovich, has been standing Ukrainian history on its head. He also was head of the SBU under the government of Viktor Yushchenko, who came to power following the Orange Revolution. That really was the pre-Maidan coup in which the OUNB fascists were rehabilitated. We're going to talk briefly, by the way, about the guy named Roman Zvarych, S-V-A-R-Y-C-H. He was the justice minister under Yushchenko and also under Yulia Tymoshenko, whom you heard referred to as laughing at an anti-Semitic comedy act. He was the personal secretary in the early 1980s to Yaroslav Stetsko. Again, Zvarych was the personal secretary to Yaroslav Stetsko in the early 1980s. He was the justice minister, the equivalent of attorney general, under Viktor Yushchenko and under both Tymoshenko governments. He is an advisor to Poroshenko and is the spokesman for the Nazi Azov battalion that is being armed and trained courtesy of the U.S. taxpayers.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Of SBU head Valentin Nalavichenko. This from Analyzing Fascist Discourse, European Fascism in Talk and Text, edited by Ruth Wolbach and John E. Richardson, published in hardcover by Routledge, publisher Routledge. And this is by Per Anders Rudling, Rudling. The Return of the Ukrainian Far Right, The Case of Vio Svoboda. A reconstructed historical memory is created as true memory, unquote, and then contrasted with, quote, false Soviet history, unquote. Thus, Valentin Nalavichenko, SBU director under Yushchenko, described the task of his agency as being to disseminate, quote, the historical truth of the past of the Ukrainian people, unquote, to, quote, liberate Ukrainian history from lies and falsifications, and to work with truthful documents only, unquote. Ignoring the OUN's anti-Semitism, denying its participation in anti-Jewish violence, and overlooking its fascist ideology, Nalavichenko and his agency presented the OUN as Democrats, pluralists, and even righteous rescuers of Jews during the Holocaust. Of course, they were no such thing. Now, again, in many ways, the Yushchenko government was sort of the pre-Maidan, Maidan coup, and the OUN elements were elevated to power under Yushchenko. They were temporarily turned out or eclipsed by succeeding governments and then returned to power in the Maidan coup in early 2014. More about Valentin Nalavichenko and his heading up the SBU, which he did following the Maidan coup and up to about 2 years ago. This from the Blogmire of April 11th of 2015 by Rob Slane, S-L-A-N-E, sort of an appropriate pun in light of what the SBU and OUNB have been justifying and apparently witnessing Mr. Sheremet engaging in. Poland stretches out its hand to the freedom fighters, skipping down. Unfortunately, the Ukrainian authorities show no signs whatsoever that they are about to abandon their admiration of those responsible for these horrific crimes. By the way, they're talking about the roughly 100,000 Polish nationals who were done to death by the OUNB government during World War II. It was sort of a war within a war. The OUNB / Ukrainian fascists, they attempted genocide against their Polish fellow citizens, killing roughly 100,000 of them in extraordinarily brutal fashion, killing them with axes, saws, burning them alive. That was one of their favorites, by the way, was herding their victims in the buildings and then setting the buildings on fire. So that is what this reference is to. Once again, from Poland, stretches out its hand to the freedom fighters by Rob Slane, an ironic title. Unfortunately, the Ukrainian authorities show no signs whatsoever that they are about to abandon their admiration of those responsible for these horrific crimes. To the contrary, they seem to be intent on admiring them all the more, as the SBU head Valentin Nalavichenko's recent words indicate. Quote, SBU does not need to invent anything extra. It is important to build on the traditions and approaches of the OUN-UPA Security Service. The point being that the SBU under Nalavichenko basically recapitulated the methodology as well as the ideology of the OUN and the UPA, both allied with Nazi Germany in World War II. Not surprisingly, one of the people whom Nalavichenko was very close to is Dmytro Yarosh, Y-A-R-O-S-H, the head of Pravi Sektor, perhaps the most virulent of the OUNB recapitulated elements in Ukraine. This from the Eurasia Daily of June 25th of 2015. Yarosh comments on dismissal of his friend Nalavichenko. Skipping down. Nalavichenko is his friend who has raised the security service from zero and has neutralized lots of terrorist threats all over the country. I know what I am talking about, as my right sector was involved in many of his special operations against Russian terrorists, Yarosh said. In the past, Yarosh was Nalavichenko's advisor. Again, Nalavichenko headed up the SBU under Viktor Yushchenko following the, quote, Orange Revolution, unquote, and then did the same thing after the Maidan coup up until 2015. And the Atlantic Council itself, very pro-OUNB and a pretty ripe organization in and of itself, funded, by the way, by the Ukrainian, in part by the Ukrainian World Congress and a Ukrainian oligarch, as well as by NATO and the U.S. State Department and the government of Lithuania. The Atlantic Council's website of June 18th of 2015, Switching Spy Masters Amid War is Risky, by Brian Mefford, M-E-F-F-O-R-D, about the dismissal of Valentin Nalavichenko and his affiliation with Pravi Sektor or Right Sector's Dmytro Yarosh. Poroshenko bloc MP Serhii Leshenko, L-E-S-C-H-E-N-K-O, released a document confirming old rumors that Right Sector's Dmytro Yarosh worked for Nalavichenko when he was a member of parliament from 2012 to 2014. While the connection between the two raises some questions about the events of Euromaidan and the origins of Right Sector, this attack alone wasn't enough to discredit Nalavichenko. Yarosh is now a member of parliament and an advisor to the chief of the general staff of the Ukrainian army. In other words, Yarosh has been legitimized by the political establishment. Again, this by way of providing some background on the political character of the SBU under Valentin Nalavichenko, one of its top officials, formerly top officials, Vasily or Vasil Vovk, V-O-V-K, called for a new Holocaust against Ukraine's Jews, and he had been the top investigator, or quote, investigator, unquote, for the SBU's, quote, investigation, unquote, of the shootdown of MH Flight 17, Malaysian Airlines Flight 17. Part of the Orwellian remake of Ukraine's history is to once again make having portrayed it as a crime to have taken action against a member of the Ukrainian Insurgent Army, or UPA, UIA or UPA. That was the militia affiliated with the OUNB, a guy who was a Jewish KGB officer and involved with hunting down one of these guys in the early 1950s, has now been charged with a crime by Volodymyr Vyatrovich. In AFA program number one, we took a look. We have also reprised this in, for the record, 777. We took a look at how the guerrilla warfare that was conducted in Eastern Europe, primarily the Baltic states and Ukraine, by Nazi-affiliated forces, and this was conducted until the early 1950s, was basically supported by the Office of Policy Coordination. That was a Frank Wisner sponsored or administered combination State Department and CIA institution that basically sponsored, armed, and ran these Nazi guerrillas in the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe until the early 1950s. Ultimately, the OPC morphed into the CIA's Directorate of Plans.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
From The Guardian of May 3rd of 2017, also by Alec Loon, L-U-H-N, Ukraine investigates 94-year-old Jewish veteran over nationalists' death in 1952. Soviet Army veteran Boris Stekler faces murder inquiry over his role in death of Ukrainian insurgent and could be jailed. Ukraine's prosecutor general has opened a murder investigation against a 94-year-old Jewish Red Army veteran over the 1952 killing of a nationalist insurgent who has been accused of collaborating with Nazis. The prosecutor general opened the investigation into the, quote, intentional killing of two or more people on the territory of Rivne region in March of 1952 by members of the administration of the State Security Ministry, unquote, according to a copy of a letter posted on the website of the National Human Rights Center, an organization which has assisted nationalists facing prosecution. The website said the case of Neil Kasevich, K-H-A-S-E-V-Y-C-H, a member of the Ukrainian insurgent army who, along with two other fighters, was killed by Soviet security forces in a standoff at that place and time. Kasevich has been accused of collaborating with the Nazis during the Second World War. By the way, that's what the UIA or UPA did. The National Human Rights Center website called him an independence fighter, unquote, and said the prosecution of his killer would give, quote, appropriate legal appraisal to the crimes of the communist epoch, unquote. The operation that killed Kasevich was headed by Boris Stekler, S-T-E-C-K-L-E-R, now a 94-year-old Jewish veteran who was decorated numerous times for bravery in the war and later served in the KGB. Stekler confirmed in a 2013 interview that he had directed the mission against Kasevich, but claimed the insurgent had shot himself before Soviet soldiers threw grenades into the bunker where he was hiding. They had given him a chance to surrender, Stekler said. Last year, the head of the Ukrainian government's National Memory Institute, Volodymyr Vyatrovich, asked the State Security Service to open its files on Stekler under a new package of decommunization laws introduced to Parliament. In addition to opening the archives, the laws made it a criminal offense to question the actions of the UIA and another nationalist group, a move condemned by international scholars as an attack on free speech. And another article that I'm not going to read at length, it talks about the heat, including lethal force, being directed against anyone who is basically a political dissident in Ukraine, whether they are actually pro-Russian or whether they are pro-Russian ethnic insurgents or simply critical of the Ukrainian government, from the Political Critique of May 3rd of 2017. Nowadays, everyone is a potential target in Ukraine by Veronica Pei and Tom Rowley. Pei is P-E-A-G and Tom Rowley, R-O-W-L-E-Y. And just to give you an idea of what is happening here, or what the article is basically laying out, we spoke to journalist Alyona Lyasheva, L-I-A-S-H-E-V-A, about the recent attacks and the situation of left-wing activists in Ukraine. On the 20th of April, by the way, that is Adolf Hitler's birthday, perhaps not coincidentally, activist Stas Sergenko, S-E-R-I-J-E-N-K-O, was brutally attacked and stabbed near his home in Kiev. He suffered serious wounds and was taken to the hospital. The incident was only one of a series of violent attacks on left-wing activists and institutions. But as Alyona Lyasheva explains, it is not only those associated with the left who have become the victims of attacks. Anyone who is seen as challenging mainstream pro-Ukrainian and pro-war views can easily become subject to repressions of different sorts. On April 20th, activist Stas Shcherbina was stabbed near his home in Kiev, who was behind the attack, AL. It is difficult to be completely sure. The police only started working on the case 3 days after the attack. That, by the way, is interesting in and of itself. But we can make some basic assumptions. For one, Stas was not robbed. The people who attacked him filmed the incident. Stas had received a lot of threats before. It makes sense to assume this was an attack from a far-right group. The leader of one such group called C-14, by the way, that's Combat 14, that is the paramilitary wing of the Svoboda organization. C-14 refers to the 14 words. Those were minted by David Lane, a member of the American Nazi group, The Order, who committed a series of bank and armored car robberies and, most famously, murdered Denver talk show host Alan Berg. I don't know the 14 words completely by memory, but it's something like, we must secure a future for our children and for the, secure a future for the white race and a future for our children, words to that effect. I can't recite them from memory, but that is what C-14 refers to, the 14 words minted by David Lane, and also the name of the paramilitary militia of Svoboda, one of the OUNB groups that has come to, one of the OUNB, the neo-OUNB groups that came to power in Ukraine. The leader of one such group, returning to Ms. Lyasheva's explanation, the leader of one such group called C-14, which has been active since the 2010s, published a blog post in one of the mainstream Ukrainian media in which he approved of the attack. It's quite likely the attackers were associated with this or a similar group, but Stas didn't recognize any of them. Has Stas suffered attacks before? AL. Yes, he was beaten after the May 1st demonstration in 2016, and he identified the attackers as members of Azov. That, again, one of the openly Nazi groups in the Ukrainian army. They fly the swastika and the SS rune on their combat helmets. Their chief spokesperson is, again, Roman Svarich, who was the personal secretary to Yaroslav Stetsko in the early 1980s. By way of chronicling the, well, really more the formalization of an old ethnic hatred in Ukraine and in many other places in Europe in general, particularly Eastern Europe, following the murder of a 9-year-old Ukrainian girl named Angelina Moshenko, Moisenko. There were a series of anti-Roma pogroms, basically. Roma are one of the groups generally known by the popular denigration as, quote, gypsies, unquote. There are two basic categories of, quote, gypsies, unquote, Roma and Sinti, and they are a traditional focal point of ethnic hatred in Europe, and they were persecuted and exterminated by the Nazis. The exact death figures vary somewhat, but there were hundreds of thousands, perhaps as many as 1.5 million Roma killed by the Nazis. From the Open Democracy, Russia and Beyond of September 18th of 2016 by Maxim Tucker, Old Hatreds Rekindled in Ukraine. The murder of a young girl in a Ukrainian village has led to the expulsion of local Roma families. In the aftermath, observers are asking whether Roma have a place in today's Ukraine. And they're talking about the killing of Angelina Moshenko. The savage nature of Angelina's killing stunned the settlement's close community. A local goat herder discovered her small body stripped, bruised, and bloody. She had been stabbed repeatedly with a screwdriver. And the suspected killer is a 21-year-old named Mikhail Shebotar, C-H-E-B-O-T-A-R, half Roma and half Bulgarian. And skipping down. Although Shebotar was immediately detained, a mob of around 300 men and teenage boys charged through the tiny village seeking out the homes of five ethnic Roma families. They gathered at 5, and by 8 they started smashing our houses and shouting, said Zenaida Damaskina, D-A-M-A-S-K-I-N-A, a 30-year-old Roma woman forced to flee with her two young sons. What did we have to wait for? When they will kill us, so we didn't take anything. We didn't have a choice. We could only run, unquote. The assailants, predominantly ethnic Bulgarians, overlooked the suspects' mixed heritage in their eagerness to blame the crime on Roma bad blood. They even overlooked the suspect's family home and his relatives. Instead, the mob chased out unrelated Roma families, many with small children of their own. They hurled rocks, kicked in doors, and set homes ablaze. A handful of uniformed police officers watched on, failing to stop the pogrom. After the Roma had been handed out, the village council passed a resolution attempting to legitimize the violence by formally expelling them. It organized buses to ferry them out to Izmail, the nearest town. So again, the village council basically endorsed the pogrom by voting to move the Roma community to a neighboring town, skipping down. Many of the regions Roma sell clothes and vegetables there, so I stopped by this in the a town of Izmail. So I stopped by a stall and asked a middle-aged Ukrainian woman where I might find Roma from Lashi Niveka. That's L-O-S-C-H-Y-N-I-V-K-A. I'm probably mispronouncing many of these Ukrainian names. Continuing. After giving me directions, she offered me her unsolicited opinion of her fellow market vendors. They should all be castrated, the gypsy bastards, skipping down. A TV poll showed that 65% of Ukrainians supported the pogroms against Roma in Lashi Niveka, said Zemfira Kondur, vice president of the Roma Women's Fund, Shirikli, C-H-I-R-I-K-L-I. Far-right groups are using that, and we're afraid that we will have more cases of hate attacks against Roma in different areas. And skipping down. In the wake of the village's expulsion of its Roma, the Azov Battalion, again the Nazi unit with the swastika and SS rune on its battalion, on its helmets, I should say, armed and trained with U.S. tax dollars, and with Roman Svarich, Yaroslav Stetsko's personal secretary in the early 1980s, as its chief spokesperson. In the wake of the village's expulsion of its Roma, the Azov Battalion, an influential nationalist group which has units fighting in eastern Ukraine, issued an inflammatory statement supporting the move. The statement branded Lashi Niveka's Roma as, quote, an ethnic mafia, unquote, led by gypsy barons, unquote. It falsely claimed that they ran drug laboratories in the village and were guilty of robberies, physical violence, intimidation, and drug trafficking. And skipping down. Hitler's genocidal slaughter of hundreds of thousands of Roma in the 20th century still generates far less research and recognition than the Holocaust against the Jews. Estimates of the dead range from 220,000 to 1.5 million. Even today, anti-Ziganism goes largely unchallenged by the societies and governments of Central and Eastern Europe. Across the continent's eastern swath, prejudice is ingrained from an early age. Parents routinely warn their children to beware of Roma, lest they take them away and force them to beg. That warning is reproduced in Ukrainian school textbooks. By the way, Mikhail Saakashvili, the former president of Georgia, who was Odessa's regional government, has, sort of winked at the pogrom against the Roma population.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
We have been talking about the Azov Battalion. They have started their own political party from the Kiev Post of October 15th of 2016. Article by Beremet, B-E-R-M-E-T, Talant, T-A-L-A-N-T. Nationalist Azov Battalion starts political party. It's about the National Corps, a political party started by the Azov Battalion. And to give people an idea about some of the things they are contemplating, this, by the way, not from a, quote, leftist, unquote, or, quote, Russian source. This from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, of October 14th of 2016. Right-wing Azov Battalion enters Ukraine's political arena, skipping down. Kravchenko, the spokesman for the group, Kravchenko told the Romansky news site he hopes that forming a party will give Azov greater political influence. Quote, there are several ways of coming to power, but we are trying something through elections. We have all sorts of other possibilities, he said. I wonder what those might be against this. This is the same group that was threatening activists and supporting the pogrom against the Roma were members of that town. It begins with an L. I can't cite it off the top of my head. And they are now starting a political party. There are several ways of coming to power. We are trying something through elections, but we have all sorts of possibilities, he said. It remains to be seen what those other possibilities might be. From the Bloomberg Business Week, October 13th of 2016, by Alan Bjerga, B-J-E-R-J-G-A, and Volodymyr Verbyany, V-E-R-B-Y-A-N-Y, that boom you hear is Ukraine's agriculture, and it is about the huge projected role of Ukraine in global grain production, and not surprisingly, how a great many transnational corporations are zooming in on that. Skipping down. The corn and sunflowers will make their way to the ports of Odessa and Mykolaiv for export, sold to Archer Daniels Midland, Cargill, and other multinationals as part of the stream of grain and oil seeds that makes Ukraine the world's fifth biggest seller of wheat and other grains. Skipping down. Ukraine is a big answer to the question of how you feed the world, said Steve Pifer, P-I-F-E-R, a former U.S. ambassador there who's now with the Brookings Institution. But it's a complex place to do business. Yeah, isn't it, though? Continuing. The country's agricultural superpowers start with its soil, called chemozem or black earth. High in humus and natural fertilizers, it's celebrated by agrarians for its fertility. Quote, in Iowa, good black soil may be a foot deep, Piper says. In Ukraine, it's 3 or 4 feet deep. Proximity to the European Union, Middle East, Russia, and Africa provides natural markets. So does suspicion of genetically modified crops. Ukraine's non-GMO corn varieties have made it China's number one source, helping to turn the former Soviet breadbasket into a global power. Skipping down. By the mid-2020s, Ukraine will be number three after the U.S. and Brazil in food production worldwide, says Martin Schuld, S-C-H-U-L-D-T, the top representative in Ukraine for Cargill, the world's largest grain trader. The company, headquartered in Minnetonka, Minnesota, saw its sunflower seed processing plant in the Donetsk region overrun by separatists in 2014. It still can't regain access to the facility. Nonetheless, the company is investing $100 million in a new grain terminal in Ukraine. Bunge, the world's biggest soy processor, opened a port this year at a ceremony with Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko, another vote of confidence in the country. Bunge also is a Borman company that was deeply implicated in the collapsing of the food oil's future market, that part was part of an apparently deliberate gambit to collapse the New York Stock Exchange on the morning of November 22nd, 1963. We've spoken about that in the past. There is a book, Were We Controlled, that talks about that. We'll perhaps reprise that book at some point in the future. Now, we are hearing all about the Russians having interfered in the U.S. political process, and there is a leap of faith between that and the many contacts between people involved with Machine Trump and people in Russia. I would point out that the point man for the Trump business empire's dealings with Russia is a guy named Felix Sater, or Sater, S-A-T-E-R. He is a Russian immigrant, an individual closely associated with American organized crime, and someone whom, as we looked at in our series of books about a series of programs about the book, The Making of Donald Trump, has worked for the CIA. That should not be overlooked. Now, basically, the same, quote, Russian intelligence, unquote, elements that supposedly hacked the DNC and Anthony DePodesta and conducted these shadow brokers attacks and other things, supposedly hacked Emmanuel Macron's campaign in France. Emmanuel Macron was the German/EU-backed candidate in the election there. He was running against Marine Le Pen, the fascist National Front candidate, who was opposing the EU that is run by Germany. Now, again, noting that the pro-German, pro-EU candidate Emmanuel Macron was supposedly the target of Russian intelligence hacks, and the same elements, the APT-28, Cozy Bear slash Fancy Bear slash the Three Little Bears and Bleep and Goldilocks, too, supposedly hacked Mr. Macron's campaign. Now, once again, I want to note, first of all, that the quote evidence here is perhaps even more laughable than what we've seen in the past, and that is pretty damn bad. No intelligence service would do anything like what we are seeing unless this is a cyber false flag operation, which it certainly is. And note that the same authorship, this is important, the same authorship is A, being attached to the hacking of the DNC, B, the hacking of the CDU in Germany, and the hacking of the Bundestag as well in Germany. And as we are going to see, not only has WikiLeaks endorsed the untenable Russia did it hypothesis, WikiLeaks being far from a progressive organization is, as we have seen in so many programs, actually a fascist network. But there was a social media campaign leading up to this hack that was conducted by American far-right groups, and it is looking very much like a guy named Andrew Arenheimer, an American hacker and the site architect for the Daily Stormer website, an honored guest at Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras' Polk Award acceptance party, appears to have been behind at least some of these documents, and the brilliant Arenheimer also is apparently currently residing in Ukraine. From the Ars Technica blog of May 8th of 2017 by Sean Gallagher, evidence suggests Russia behind hack of French president-elect. This is by Sean Gallagher. Late on May 5th, as the two final candidates for the French presidency were about to enter a press blackout in advance of the May 7th election, 9 gigabytes of data allegedly from the campaign of Emmanuel Macron were posted on the Internet in torrents and archives. The files, which were initially distributed via links posted on 4chan and then by WikiLeaks, had forensic metadata suggesting that Russians were behind the breach and that a Russian government contract employee may have falsified some of the dumped documents. Even WikiLeaks, which initially publicized the breach and defended its integrity on the organization's Twitter account, has since acknowledged that some of the metadata pointed directly to a Russian company with ties to the government. Now, note this. This is, I really have to watch my language because we're on it. This is a bleeping joke. No intelligence service is going to do this. Skipping down. Evrika, E-V-R-I-K-A, or Eureka, Z-A-O, is a large information technology company in St. Petersburg that does some of the work for the Russian government, and the group includes the Federal Security Service of the Russian Federation, or FSB, among its acknowledged customers, as noted in this job listing. The company is a systems integrator, and it builds its own computer equipment and provides, quote, integrated information security systems, unquote. The metadata in some Microsoft Office files shows the last person to have edited the files to be, quote, Ruska Georgi Petrovich, a current or former Evrika ZAO employee. Right, I mean, Russian intel is going to perform this and then leave metadata, including email addresses and the name of the guy who edited. This is a bleeping goddamn joke. According to a Trend Micro report on April 25th, the Macron campaign was targeted by the Pawn Storm threat group, also known as Fancy Bear or APT, in the March 15 phishing campaign using the domain OneDrive en Marche France. The domain was registered by a Johnny Pinch, unquote, using a mail.com webmail address. The same threat group's infrastructure and malware was found to be used in the breach of the Democratic National Committee in 2016, in the phishing attack targeting members of the presidential campaign of former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and in a number of other campaigns against political targets in the U.S. and Germany over the past year. The metadata attached to the upload of the Macron files also included some identifying data with an email address for the person uploading the content to archive.org. Sure, that's going to happen. Right. That's what every hacker does, right? By the way, I'm being facetious. In the article from an article from the Wall Street Journal of May 16th of 2017 by David Gauthier-Villars, U.S. hacker linked to fake Macron documents, says cybersecurity firm. Ties between an American's neo-Nazi website and an internet campaign to smear Macron before French election are found. A group of cybersecurity experts has unearthed ties between an American hacker who maintains a neo-Nazi website and an internet campaign to smear Emmanuel Macron days before he was elected president of France. And talking about information pointing to a site, quote, a site is also hosted by a server in Latvia that hosts the Daily Stormer, a neo-Nazi news site that identifies its administrator as Weave, another alias of Andrew Arnheimer. We strongly believe that the fake offshore documents were created by someone with control of the Daily Stormer server, said Tord Lundstrom, a computer forensic investigator at Virtual Road. .org. Skipping down again. Intelligence and cybersecurity investigators examining the flurry of social media activity leading up to the hack followed a trail of computer code that they say leads back to the American far right. I dare say the same thing should be viewed as characteristic of the hack of the DNC. Contacted by email over the weekend, the publisher of the Daily Stormer, Andrew Anglin, said he and the site's architect, Mr. Auernheimer, had used their news site to write about the fake documents. Skipping down. Asked if Mr. Auernheimer resided in Ukraine, as a January post on the personal blog indicates, his lawyer said, quote, "I think this is about right," unquote. The point being that this ludicrous, you know, fancy bear, cozy bear, APT-2829 that hacked the DNC and so forth, and the German Bundestag and the CDU, almost certainly was a, not only a cyber false flag operation, but in this case, the evidence tracks back to Andrew Auernheimer, again, a guest of Glenn Greenwald at his and Laura Poches's Polk Award acceptance party. Sadly, that's business as usual for Glenn Greenwald, as we looked at in For the Record 888. I would also point out that WikiLeaks Russian operations are run by Joran Jermos, a.k.a. Israel Shamir, a doctrinaire fascist with close ties to the Ukrainian fascist milieu as well. And I think we can assume that just as the American neo-Nazis and the far right were involved with trying to deep six Emmanuel Macron, they in all likelihood were involved with doing the same thing against Hillary Clinton and the DNC. But we have not heard about that. Again, we'll consult the description for the Record 959 for details. This concludes For the Record program number 959. Update on the new Cold War and the Nazification of Ukraine. This is being recorded on June 1st of the year 2017. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.